Welcome to the Be Loud About What Matters podcast. I'm Olivia, your host. On this podcast, I will be bringing light to topics that are important but not discussed enough within our society. Episodes will include a range of topics, starting with the journey to conceive, pregnancy, birth, postpartum and motherhood, holistic healing and nutrition, and the importance of true informed consent and medical freedom. The goal of this podcast is to create connections, share stories, information, and resources to educate and empower people in their own personal journey. Hello, listeners. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Be Loud About What Matters podcast. This week, I have an incredible mama friend on with me, Nikki. Nikki and I connected on Instagram, and we connected mostly because we had very similar views when it came to holistic health and birth and pregnancy and life and everything. So very easy to just sit and chat with each other. So Nikki, welcome to the podcast. I'm so happy to have you. Do you mind sharing a bit about you with everyone?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, thank you so much for having me on. I'm very excited to be here. I've been listening to your podcast for a while, and I just enjoy so much about it and all of the people that you have on. It's really great. Yeah, my name is Nikki. I'm married to James, who is a naval officer. He's currently on deployment. And then we have two boys, Jesse, who's 2, and Charlie, who turned 1 2 days ago.
Oh my gosh, happy belated birthday. I know.
I'm like so not ready for him to not be a baby anymore, but
oh my gosh, it's just
it goes too
flies.
Fast.
It flies. Oh yeah. Well, yeah, I didn't know that your husband was on deployment right now. I had no idea.
Yeah, he left right after Mother's Day, so he's been gone for a little while, but he'll be back like mid-late September. Looking forward to that.
Yeah. So how is that when he's gone? That must be difficult to manage everything.
Yeah, it has its challenges for sure. And we are stationed in San Diego and both of our families are in Seattle.
Okay.
So we do have good friends about an hour from where we're living. And so that's the support that I have there, which is really great. But I come back and visit my family when he's gone just to see them and have a little bit more help. So
yeah,
it's manageable. You know. Yeah.
And I'm glad you have that too, because I've connected with a lot of mamas whose husbands are deployed or they're gone for a certain amount of time and then they get used to having them home and then they're back again. And it's just, yeah, it's in a transition period for everybody, whether, especially like if they are pregnant and their baby is due at any time and they're waiting. So props to you, mama. Would you mind sharing a bit about like what your pregnancy looked like, what your plans were surrounding birth, if that's different now than it was when you first were pregnant?
Yeah. So home birth was always like a very normal thing for me. My mom had all of us at home. I'm 1 of 8.
Oh my gosh.
And she had all of us at home.
That
so,
is so
two of my
cool.
siblings are adopted.
Okay.
But so she had 6 home births. And so it was always very normal. Like I grew up with language like cascade of interventions and why go to the hospital if you don't need medical attention and like all of that. It was very, very normal.
Wow. That's
and
awesome.
So when I was pregnant with my first, it wasn't even a thought that I was going to have him at home. My husband, who's 1 of 6, you know, his mom had all hospital births. And so even then it wasn't at all like, you know, we need to have this discussion or like trying to convince him or anything. It was just like, this is what I'm doing. And he was like, okay, great. Well, you know, what can I do? And it was just very normal. Like it took a long time for me to even realize like how kind of taboo home birth is. And all through my pregnancy, people would tell me I was brave, you know, for having a home birth, which always bugged me.
I know.
Or, you know, my cousin's sister's neighbor, you know, would have died if they'd had a home birth or like, you know,
they
just
say, yeah,
just the craziest stuff. So I did choose just, I don't know, pretty basic midwives that were within the radius to be able to attend my home birth. And so they were the only ones that I interviewed and it felt fine.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any concept of midwifery care being very heavily medicalized. So there wasn't anything at the time for me to kind of discern or look at in a very discriminating way. Like, do I want this? Do I not want this?
So do you mean more of like a medwife?
Yeah.
That's what you mean. Okay.
Yeah, it was pretty heavily medicalized. So my labor with Jesse, my pregnancy was pretty normal. I did throw up for a long time. But other than that, I mean, I didn't have like complications, you know?
Okay.
nothing that would have like risked me out of having them at my birth. So with my labor, it was just kind of long and slow for a while. And then when it did pick up, it had been a while that they had been there. She checked me at about 9 p.m. and I was at an 8. The baby wasn't born until after midnight.
Okay.
And so I was kind of in that 8 to 10 place for a while. And when my water broke, it had meconium in it. And I think she just kind of hit the panic button a little bit because
okay.
she told me right then when she checked me, like, we need to get this baby out. And it was scary at the time.
And what time was that you said that?
That was at like 12:15 or 12:20. I only pushed for like 15 minutes.
Okay.
And so I feel like she did kind of hit the panic button. Knowing what I know now, of course, I could say that about 50 things in both of my labors, you know, I would do things differently. So I was pretty freaked out. When he was born, I asked my husband, I think 10 times in the 5 seconds that it took the baby to cry, like, is he okay? Is he okay? So then, of course, he was fine. And then after my undisturbed third stage, the midwife just said, this is more blood than I'm comfortable seeing. And she gave me 2 shots of Pitocin.
Oh.
And like didn't really explain the risks or like, I mean, I was fine. I had like 0 signs of shock. I wasn't seeing stars. I wasn't weak. I was pink, you know, in my cheeks, and I was alert and I was talking and happy. And again, like it didn't seem necessary looking back. And so after his birth, I had a lot of difficulty breastfeeding. I used a nipple shield for 14 months, which I know is not a long-term solution, but I did have postpartum depression and it felt much more manageable to use a nipple shield, you know, than it did to go to lactation consultant appointments and like try to do anything bigger than that. You know, I was like, I could handle using a nipple shield. I don't think I can handle all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And so there were, yeah, life circumstances that I think contributed to it. My husband went back to work the day after the baby was born. It was pretty rough, but I definitely think that the Pitocin had a lot to do with it.
And that's something a lot of people won't talk about or don't realize.
No, they either don't know or they frankly don't care. If the provider deems it necessary, they don't really care a lot of the time what the risks are.
Right.
You know, and from a pragmatic point of view, they'd say, okay, well, depression's better than bleeding out or something like that. But that's not even what was the situation. So,
I mean, it's like the phrase, a healthy baby is all that matters. And
right. I mean, that's really, really how it felt. I was not doing well. And that was very much the message, was like, well, but you have this baby.
Yeah.
You know, how could anything be wrong when you have this baby? And partly that was, you know, my own inner voice, and partly that's just the world that we live in. So,
yeah, I think that's a thing that a lot of moms deal with, though. Like, they have all of these feelings in regards to, like, if their birth was traumatic or if it went a completely different way than they thought it would. And then they don't feel like they can share, hey, I'm really struggling, or hey, I feel like I should be really happy, but I'm not really happy because I'm trying to process this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just so much guilt that comes along with it. And I've talked to so many moms, and it's like they hold all these feelings inside for a long time sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
It takes a person to talk about it, like try to get them to open up and talk about it. But it's just crazy that we live in a world where they're like, oh, well, you're happy and your baby's alive, so that means you should just be happy.
That means everything's fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember like when I went in for my 8-week check and my midwife could tell that I was very not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked me to do the postpartum depression screening, and it had 2 slots to describe how you've been feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2 words that I used were, I feel empty and I feel alone. It was such a strange feeling. Like I can still remember feeling like very out of body when I would just sit with my baby.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was so, so happy, like genuinely over the moon, and so sad.
Yeah.
And feeling both of those things at the same time is bizarre. I mean,
it's bizarre.
Like, it's indescribable. Yeah.
And it's just like these intense feelings. It's because it's not just what you would feel on a normal day-to-day basis. Like, you
right.
gave birth to a child. So
right.
not only did you just become a new person, like as a mother,
right.
and then you just gave birth to a new person. And then it's just like these extreme hormonal waves that come in
mm-hmm.
and out. And it's just like, people do not realize whether it's the mom themselves or their husband or their partner, whoever, they don't realize how intense that could be in the moment. And sometimes I feel like people don't even know what to say when they want to express how they feel, but they just don't know how to.
100%. So I didn't end up medicating or seeking any kind of therapy or anything. And it just kind of passed with time. Some circumstances changed in our lives that just alleviated a lot of the pressure that we were feeling at the time. And so it just kind of went away on its own. When I was about 7 months postpartum, Jesse was 7 months, I got pregnant with Charlie.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So yeah, they're pretty close together, but I mean, we use fertility awareness. And so the whole time after Jesse was born, you know, we were playing that, like, if we're going to be together, are we prepared for a baby kind of game? And like,
could you just share a little bit about what fertility awareness looks like for you, just in case people who are listening don't know what that means?
Yeah. So fertility awareness method is tracking your cycles and optimizing either your infertile times or your fertile times, depending on whether you want to avoid or conceive. And so what that looks like, depending on how serious you are about wanting to space or avoid, abstaining beginning on a certain day in your cycle, and then through ovulation, and then picking back up before the next cycle.
Okay.
So with postpartum cycles, it's a lot more tricky. And in normal cycles, you know, you have 7 to 10 days a month that are either fertile or the ones that you'd want to avoid if you don't want a baby at that time. In normal cycles, if you're trying to avoid, it's much more manageable. But postpartum, it's a lot more unpredictable because you never know when that egg's going to drop before your first period. And so
I know
that for a lot of women, after they have a baby, the combination of their body changing and their hormones and their exhaustion, they just aren't interested in sex. You know, it's not a reflection of their partner. It's them, you know, everything's changing and going on. And I experienced like the exact opposite. My husband was the only thing that I really wanted. it was just that I knew that that would help, you know, the loneliness. And I just wanted part of my life to feel like it hadn't changed. And so that was really hard. But that's why after the 6 month mark, when Jesse was 6 months old, I was like, forget this. And so we got pregnant the 7th month. So we were definitely expecting it, and we hadn't been avoiding, so we were prepared for it. He is new to the Navy. He hasn't been in long. And so he found out that he got into officer candidate school on a particular Friday. And the next day I found out I was pregnant with Charlie.
Oh my gosh.
So we've only been married for a little over 3 years, and it's just been nonstop the whole time. We got pregnant with Charlie on our honeymoon.
Oh, wow.
And it has been nonstop ever since. That was a fun, kind of crazy time. And so he left. He was gone almost my whole pregnancy with Charlie. When he got back from OCS, we were told we had a week to be in San Diego. So we packed up everything from the Seattle area.
Oh, wow.
And moved down when I was 36 weeks pregnant.
So it really has been nonstop, to say the least.
Yeah. Like, that's an understatement. It's been absolutely crazy.
That is wild. It's just literally like a roller coaster, just not stopping.
So this is his third time being gone. Like, it's his first deployment, but he's had to go away for trainings.
Okay.
So he was gone right as everything closed down in 2020. One of the last conversations we had in person was like, I don't know, there's this virus that people are catching in China. I don't really know what's going to happen. They're talking about closing down travel. And then we were like, that's probably not going to happen.
So what was it like during your pregnancy, and what was your birth like? I mean, I'm sure that looked very different compared to what your first birth looked like.
Yeah. So I don't really receive a lot of prenatal care in my pregnancies. So with Jesse, my first prenatal appointment was on the first day of my third trimester.
Okay.
And then with Charlie, my first prenatal appointment was when I was 36 weeks.
Wow. That is so awesome to hear. Can you share a little bit about that? Because a lot of the time people think that you need to go in and you need all these ultrasounds and procedures and tests and blah, blah, blah. But I would just love to hear about what your pregnancy looked like outside of that, because you didn't receive all of that.
Mm-hmm. I did end up, this is one of the areas that I would do things very differently. I did end up playing some catch up with some of those tests. Like I did do the diabetes screening and the group B strep test and all of that. In both, they were just a lot later than standard procedure, right?
Right.
And so even my provider at the time, my OB with Charlie, was like, yeah, we got to play catch up, you know, because we only have basically 3 to 5 weeks until you have this baby.
Right.
So in a way, it was very, very liberating. That's the most significant thing that I feel about not having received care, because I wasn't worried about it. You know, I see all the time in various moms groups, like, I just need to get to my X week appointment so that I can have my ultrasound and feel like everything's okay.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's productive. I understand where they're coming from, you know, especially a mom who has a history of loss or something like that. So I definitely feel for them. I just also know that if I was, you know, counting down the days till the next appointment, that would be the confirmation that everything's okay. Mm-hmm. That's not for me.
Yeah. I remember feeling that way. And granted, I've only been pregnant once, but they were sitting there and they were talking about all these different tests, and I didn't have a home birth. I had a hospital birth and a birth center. So, but I remember sitting there and listening to them talk about all these different tests, like amniocentesis and all of this stuff. And I was just like, is this really necessary?
Yeah.
And I remember them talking about, you get these tests and then they still might not even be accurate.
Right.
And so I'm like, okay, so we're going to go through these intense tests to get information that might not even be accurate about our baby.
Some that carry enormous risk,
enormous
like amniocentesis.
Oh my gosh. And so for those listening who aren't familiar with amniocentesis, like, they literally take a massive needle and put it into your belly. Like, there are so
but
many
from the outside. It's not even like a vaginal insertion. No. It's from the outside.
But even
like, how can this be a good idea?
Yeah. And even the vaginal insertions, that stuff is just all of it is so invasive, and people don't realize. And I think you and I could sit here and talk about the importance of true informed consent in regards to these things in general. Birth and pregnancy is just better if it's just left alone, unless there's like something that really worries you or really worries your midwife or something that you really want to have checked, then you generally don't need all of these different tests.
Absolutely.
And like, you and I have talked about it so many times, like, you can say no. It's your choice. It's your body. It's your choice. Your provider is not the boss. They work for you. So
100%.
I'm glad that you're sharing that, and I'm glad that you spend time talking about that on your social media platforms too, because we need to talk about this. We need to talk about birth and what it looks like and what it can look like.
100%.
Okay. So keep telling me more about, so you had your first ultrasound at 36 weeks and then they played a little.
Yeah. So I had, you know, what they call entertainment ultrasounds, which again, seems kind of insane, like when you think about it, at 20 weeks for both, just to find out the gender. So it was like a 10 minute scan.
Oh, okay.
In like a completely separate non-medical office that we have here in the Seattle area. And so other than that, I didn't have any with Jesse after that. And then when I was 36 weeks, they wanted to schedule one, you know, quote, just to check things out, which I wouldn't do now. And this is the part that gets a little more rough in Charlie's pregnancy. So at 37 weeks was when I had my ultrasound and an OB appointment scheduled in the same day. So I went to my ultrasound appointment first, and he was already head down and engaged. So they weren't getting a good look at his brain.
Okay.
And so they told me that they were going to do a transvaginal ultrasound. It wasn't a question. It was like, this is what we're going to do. And I don't know if you've ever had a transvaginal ultrasound.
Nope.
But it's pretty horrible physically and emotionally. Like, it.
So that must have been very uncomfortable.
And it's just completely different when it's not, you know, like your partner, your husband, somebody that you know and want. Like, it's this foreign object that looks very much like a particular tool. Yeah. So they like lubricate it. And I mean, it's just like, it's so awful. If you've never had one, it's awful if you have had one, but they still didn't get a good look at his brain. They were like, your cervix is in the way. I was like, yeah, it's supposed to be there. It's a cervix.
That's supposed to be there.
Yeah, I was like, I didn't just put it up there to put it in your way. Like, it actually stays there. I don't know if you knew that, but
that's where it lives.
Yeah, it stays put. Yeah, they still didn't get a good look. So it was even more like, then why did I even have to go through that? So I was really sore physically, and I just cried like the whole way to my OB appointment. And then at my OB appointment, that was when I had my group B strep screening. So I had my bottoms off and the little paper towel blanket thing over my lap. And my OB informed me that she would be checking my cervix.
So no asking.
No, definitely no asking. And I mean, I was 37 weeks. Like, who cares how dilated my cervix is, especially at 37 weeks, but like in general, what does it matter?
But that's common. For them check it. Like, that's common. That's, like, a lot of people think that that's normal. That's just part of what the appointment looks like.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what they told me at 36 weeks was we start cervical checks at 37 weeks.
Yeah. And by common, I said that in air quotes for everyone who's not. Yeah. Who's not.
I mean, common, but not normal, right? Yes. There is a difference. Yes. So, yeah. So she informed me that she'd be checking my cervix. She, without even like really taking a breath, she walked over and like put her hand on my shoulder to lay me down on the table and forced her hand all the way up to my cervix. Like, didn't go slow, you know, obviously didn't ask, just really went for it, finding my cervix, and then yanked her hand back out, told me I was at a one, pointed to my hospital packet on the counter and said, see you next week. And she walked out while I was still lying on the table.
See, and this is where they have this whole week for birth trauma awareness, but like, let's actually call it what it is. It's obstetric violence, and it could
100%
absolutely not exist if we didn't have people who stepped over their boundaries and just did these things to women without even a blink of an eye. Like, they just don't care.
And the thing is, I was not the first person she did that to.
No.
And I was not the last. Like, nobody abuses someone once. No one. It's literally never a one-time offense.
Especially when it comes to not even just the birth space, but the medical space. And it's just scary and it's disheartening. And I can't even tell you how many women I have heard these types of stories from, whether it's on the podcast or in my DMs or whatever, or listening to podcasts. And it's just, it's crazy to me. It is just, and it breaks my heart. It really does. And ever since March of 2020, I have just been very concerned about what that means for everyone in the birth space. Mothers, babies, husbands, partners, I've been so worried about it. And honestly, it's just gotten worse and worse.
Yeah. My thoughts are like racing after telling. Yeah, I don't talk about it much.
I'm sorry. But I can't imagine what that was like for you.
Well, and I mean, I have like a post on my Instagram, and it says birth trauma is normal and normal is crossed out, and it just says common. Mm-hmm. Like, it's actually very not normal. So, I mean, some birth trauma, quote unquote, is unavoidable, right? Mm-hmm. Bad things happen. That's life. Some of that, I mean, life has risk, right? Some of it is unavoidable, and 90 to 95% of it is completely avoidable. It's that we put women through these horrible things and then expect them not to be traumatized.
Right.
Which is just absolutely insane.
Expect them not to be traumatized. And then it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Like, they could be traumatized and they don't know how to talk about it, or they don't feel ready to talk about it, or they feel like they can't talk about it because other people who were at their birth may not view their trauma as something that is traumatic for them.
Well, and even so, Gabor Mate is, I believe, a psychologist. I don't remember his credentials, but he talks about trauma being your brain's response to something awful, not the awful thing itself. So most women who have been abused probably aren't walking around saying, I have birth trauma.
Okay.
That doesn't change the fact that they were abused.
What was that person's name?
Gabor Mate. It's G-A-B-O-R, and then his last name is M-A-T-E, and the E has an accent.
Okay. I'm gonna look it up. I'm not familiar with him, so I would like to look that up and then share it in the show notes with everybody.
Yeah, he has quite a bit about trauma, more from like the childhood kind of angle.
Okay.
And how childhood trauma affects the rest of your life. But yeah, he talks quite a bit about how trauma is the response to something bad happening. It's not the bad thing itself. And that's why people respond differently to things like being assaulted.
Right.
Or witnessing something horrible. You know, people are able to handle that in different ways. And that's why. So most women who have been abused by their providers have no idea because abuse is so normalized.
Right. And that's the thing that always makes me so angry when I hear these things, because the issue is, I mean, there's many issues, but one of the biggest issues is that there are these different things that they do that are red flags that people don't realize are red flags because it's just deemed normal, in air quotes, and it's not. And it literally makes my blood boil because there are so many situations within the pregnancy, birth, postpartum, every aspect that could be avoided if we just had someone to step in and be like, hey, no, that's not okay. I always say we shouldn't have to advocate for ourselves as much as we do during birth. Like, we just should not have to do that. These people should not be doing these things to women. They just shouldn't be doing them.
You shouldn't be at war with your provider.
No, you should not.
You shouldn't have to.
It shouldn't be the situation like yours where they're just like, okay, this is what we're going to do. I'm not even going to ask you, and I'm just going to shove my hand inside of you. And it sounds so vulgar when I say it like that. But that's literally
what happened.
Yeah, it's reality. And sometimes, honestly, like, people don't want to hear that. And they just want to say, oh, well, they were just doing what they are supposed to do. And
it's that excuse.
And they know better. And no.
I'm like, what a wonderful way to absolve an abuser of their actions is to just say, well, they were doing it for your own good.
Right.
I mean, imagine if we applied that to any other abusive scenario.
Right. And that's the thing, is that people just don't even think about it like that, or they're afraid, you know?
I mean, I think it has a lot to do with confronting their own abuse.
Right.
You know, or to accept that this huge portion of people's lives, this reliance on the medical system as being based on a lie. That's incredibly difficult for people to wrap their heads around or even broach the topic. I don't blame them.
Yeah.
You know, I understand the shift that you have to make in order to come to terms with that. I understand the pain of realizing that someone you thought you could trust hurt you. Like, I understand.
Yeah.
And it's still worth talking about.
And I would really love to open up a conversation about what you just shared. So talking about the fact that we have been taught that our bodies are so incapable of things that are literally natural and things that women have been doing since the beginning of time. And like you said, just this mindset that these medical providers know better than we do, or they know about our bodies more than we do. So we should just do whatever they say because it's whatever they think is best. It's not based on what we feel ourselves is best. And it's something that applies in every aspect of life, is like, we as a society have been so far removed from what's natural in every way. But you see it so much when it comes to birth.
Absolutely.
And it makes me angry. And it also really genuinely makes me sad, because women and their babies and their husbands or partners are literally robbed of what birth could be like. Every single day. Every single day they're robbed of it. And then they go on to, A, they'll have a traumatic birth. It'll be traumatic for mom, baby, and husband or partner. And then they think that that's normal. And then that's what they continue to do for future births. And I was horrified. I'm in a few different doula groups in Massachusetts. And I just keep seeing these like horrible, horrible posts from doulas talking about these violent care providers. And I just saw a post literally as recently as this week that said, hey, this family is looking for a postpartum doula, but they need someone who has experience with babies because this 3-month-old baby has brain damage from a vacuum delivery, a vacuum assisted delivery. And for me, I couldn't even respond to that post.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was so angry. And I don't know I don't know the background or anything like that, but it's just like everything that I know about birth that I've seen, that probably, like most likely, like there's probably 90% or 95% that was not necessary, but that mom was probably induced or God knows what else. And now they have a brand new baby who has brain damage from that.
And who bears the weight of that? Not the doctor.
Not the doctor. You know that much. Financially, emotionally, physically, all of that. Mother, baby, father. You know, like it's just like that makes me so angry because it makes me so sad for that family.
Mm-hmm. But it's a very righteous anger. I mean, I see posts all the time of women. I'm in a couple different mom groups, and this one had her first baby at the same time that I had Charlie and was just posting asking for prayer because she is terrified to her core of getting pregnant and having to go through birth again. And I just understand that it would not be well received if I told her that's because you had a really crappy provider. Or that's because you birthed within the system or anything like that. Because, I mean, she had a healthy baby. She's, you know, healthy, whatever that means. But she knows that something was wrong. And her reason was just, I just can't do that again. You know, it's not going deeper. And it's, again, going back to that realization, that process that you have to undergo to realize the reality of it. And your brain, in order to keep you alive, sometimes will not broach that topic because it's too painful.
I don't know. I see things like that and I get so angry because it just could have been avoided. And I know, and I've seen it so many times. And I think also too, the thing that really, really irks me even more so, and you can probably relate to this, is just that these providers are saying these fear-mongering things to a new mother and a new father who's listening along. And they're like, oh my God, like I have to do these things because if not, X, Y, and Z could happen. And
they play the dead baby card.
Yes. And
it's over. Like, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
If there's a dead baby, that's what's at stake. Mm-hmm. We will do literally anything
to avoid that.
And they know that. And they exploit.
And most of the time what they're talking about is not, they don't have any sort of evidence.
No, it's they not have no evidence. Reason to say that.
Yeah, they have no evidence-based research. And then it just goes back into the fact that most OBs have not actually seen what a natural unmedicated birth looks like. And then also most labor and delivery nurses have not either. Mm-hmm. And it makes me angry and frustrated. And it also, again, just ties back into the fact that there is such a lack of education surrounding what birth should look like and could look like.
The safety that exists in that, relative safety, because life isn't safe, but the fact that there is much more safety in an undisturbed birth.
Yes.
But these calls that are that close, right? Life or death, C-section or death, most of the time are either a lie or it wasn't that close of a call until they made it.
Right.
That's a very, very uncomfortable thing for people to hear. Again, because it's horrible to be told that your baby almost died. Mm-hmm. Right. That's our greatest fear as a mother. Right. I'm not even going to say as a parent, because fathers love their children and I get that. And that's a really wonderful, special bond. There is something different about mothers and their children. Mm-hmm. It's 100% normal and the way that it's supposed to be. We grew them, we nurture them, we nourish them, and dead baby is our greatest fear.
Yeah. And also too, just the topic of induction, just talking about it in general. People don't realize that your due date is an estimation. It's not like, okay, ding, baby's supposed to be here.
Well, I think estimation is even generous because it's literally a random calculation. Not that a man in the 1800s exactly. pulled out of the air. It's not even like this is when most women have their baby, because it's not. If that were the case, we'd be talking about 41 and 1. Why don't we just change the date to that? If your provider told you that you're supposed to have your baby by 36 weeks,
right?
Would you say yes to an induction?
And that's the thing, is that people think, okay, baby's supposed to be here if it's like a few days or a day after the due date, and they're like, oh, your baby hasn't dropped or blah, blah, blah. People are like, oh, I have to have an induction. Like, duh, I have to have one.
Because or I have to have one at 42 weeks or my midwife will drop me.
Right.
You know, that the oversight of midwifery care by obstetrics, the appropriation of the term midwife by the obstetric field is essentially an OB in midwife's clothing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, stuff like you have to be induced by 42 weeks, bringing Pitocin with you to a home birth, amniotomies, cervical checks, all of these things that exist in the hospital that you're choosing a home birth in order to avoid, and they still show up. Modern midwifery care in America, mainstream midwifery care, regulated licensed midwives are not what midwives used to be. People at least need to know that. You're free to choose whatever you want, but don't choose a midwife just because their title is midwife. You know, right. You don't actually know anything about their philosophy or their practice just by their title.
Yeah, and I think it just genuinely just comes back down to doing your own research to be truly informed about the decisions that you have to make during pregnancy and birth.
And living with radical responsibility.
Yes, thank you. I was just going to say, and Kylie and I were talking about this last week on the podcast, like taking responsibility for your pregnancy, your birth, and for really educating and preparing yourself for it, whether that's like mentally, physically, emotionally, everything ties into it.
Mm-hmm. You birth how you live. If your whole life is shifting to someone else, well, somebody else told me to do this, then I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. Then that's how your birth will be too. Why do you expect that to be different?
Right. I just think back to, I wholeheartedly wanted to have a home birth for my first. And the only reason I didn't was because my daughter's dad wanted the hospital portion, because we both come from very medicalized families. And mm-hmm. I literally would have been fine giving birth at home. But I remember advocating for myself in the beginning. Like, I had midwives. I had a midwife that I was working with. But I knew that I needed to be like, this is what I'm doing. And mm-hmm. I made them put it in my notes, in my charts every single time. Because I didn't mm-hmm. want anybody to bother me. Like,
yeah.
And I still, like, even now, like, there are things that I look back upon. Like, I never would have gotten cervical checks. I never mm-hmm. would have been had the monitor on me 24/7. Mm-hmm. I never would have gotten Pitocin afterwards. Like, there was literally no reason for all of these things. And so even when you do know all of these things, there's still more that you learn from your experience.
Absolutely. I mean, I played over in my head repeatedly what it would have looked like if I had just stayed home and birthed Charlie by myself. And you can't change the past, obviously.
Right.
And I did choose a hospital birth with him. I'm very thankful that my OB was not there the day that I had him. I had a hospital midwife and nurse who was super nice. And overall, I mean, that's why I do have a hard time saying that I had, you know, a traumatic birth or something like that, because that's not really when the abuse happened. It was before,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so I hold no judgment for women who go back, because I did. I was abused and I went back. You know, it takes a massive shift to say no more. Right. And I completely understand when and why people don't.
Right.
So I did have him in a hospital near our house. I showed up 3 hours before he was born, so they didn't really have time to do anything. My goal was to walk in, you know, as he was falling out of my body. And yeah, so I was only there for about 3 hours. It was the same. My water didn't break until he was crowning. And so the midwife had stepped out. The nurse was doing something on her computer. I was just laboring with my husband. And when my water broke, I looked up at him and I said, he's coming. And my husband told the nurse, like, the baby's coming. And she was like, yeah, oh, okay. Zero urgency. Didn't believe me. She looks and she's like, oh, so he's coming. And I was like,
actually coming.
Uh-huh. That's what I said. And so she ran to get the midwife. And by the time that they came back, his head was out. So they got there like just in time to literally catch him. My husband was poised to get down there and catch him himself. So,
wow.
Yeah. So then that was, I mean, I didn't tear. I had zero perineal or vaginal pain after his birth. I had some after pain cramping, but I mean, that healing time overall was great. He had a completely fine time breastfeeding. I used a nipple shield just to get through engorgement. And then he was off by about 3 weeks and hasn't used it since, which has been such a blessing because a nipple shield is a pain.
Yeah, and like you said, everyone has like different experiences with certain things that they like feel like they need at that time because they're not ready to address something else, or because they just feel like it would be too much if they were to approach it in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I co-founded and co-hosted the Fiat podcast, which I know you know about. It's since had a name change. It's now Wombs Made Worthy.
Okay.
And I ended up leaving because almost all of the women that we had had on had been abused to some capacity. And by not talking about it, I was actively normalizing it. And I was not okay with that. I had tried to talk about what happened in a particular woman's birth. They had told her they wanted to induce to prevent preeclampsia. And she had, you know, every intervention in the book. They broke her water without real consent or even informing her of the risks. So they broke her water and she was at an 8 and her cord dropped.
Oh, wow.
So they rushed her out for a C-section. And even telling it, like, I could tell that she was trying to process through, you know, how much of this was really necessary. If I had said no to the Pitocin, you know, would I have needed the epidural that caused the weak contractions that led to the amniotomy? You know, she's like working through all of it, thinking that her induction was still necessary and feeling good about that. But then where did it kind of go off from where she thought it would be? So they gave her a C-section and she said, you know, I believe that because I had midwives, they wanted me to have a vaginal birth. And I said, did you believe that at the time? And she said, yeah. And I said, do you believe it now? And she was like, yeah. Like, I could tell she was really trying to work through it. And I was just trying to be honest. Like, it seems like if they had wanted to avoid a C-section, they would have done things to avoid a C-section. And I can understand. We ended up getting mail from a guest or a woman who had said she wanted to be a guest, basically saying that it sounded like we were questioning the guest and her providers about their decisions, like in a very, you know, why did you do that kind of a way? So Laura and I decided together to just kind of ease up on the tone or the angle while still asking questions and still asking things like, did they inform you of the risks?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought for a while that I could do that. We did a few more interviews. And basically the reason why I left was one woman in particular, she was diagnosed with gestational diabetes, which when she said that, she said, you know, so the birth that I wanted automatically went out the window. And I mean, after we got the email about our approach, every single episode after that, I was just biting my tongue because I want to jump in and say, well, that's not necessarily what you have to do. You know, of course you can't change the past, but for the future and for anyone else listening, that's not what you have to do. You don't even have to get the gestational diabetes screening. You know, I wanted to like talk about all of this stuff. And I just wasn't, because I knew that that wasn't the angle of the platform, right? That wasn't why we were there. And so she's telling her story. She had a routine induction at 39 weeks. The baby was like 6 pounds something, a pretty small baby, especially considering the reason for inducing it 39 weeks for gestational diabetes is a huge baby, right?
Right.
He was 6 something. She had had a Pitocin induction and she'd had an epidural. So she'd been pushing for 15 minutes and the baby was born. And then the doctor tells her that he's going to stitch her up because he had given her an episiotomy and used the vacuum.
My jaw is dropping for everyone who's not sitting in this call right now.
Thoughts. His reason was, quote, because he thought the baby was going to get stuck.
Got it. So you just automatically like snipped somebody's vagina just because you thought that that was a good idea and didn't even ask them.
Pushing for 15 minutes, a 6-pound baby. I was just in complete disbelief and more upset that she was not upset. And I understand, just like we've been talking about, that it's very difficult, impossible in some cases, to think about it in those terms. My provider cut my genitals without asking. To say those words and to really wrap your head around the reality of that, painful, painful, painful. Like, I get it, and I do, and I still couldn't be the one not saying that's assault.
That's the thing that's, like, so difficult about this space that we're in, even with what we share on Instagram, because we share these things talking about the importance of true informed consent because we want people to know, not yes. because we're here to shame you yes. for what happened. That's not what it's about. What it's about is making sure that people have the education and the resources to fully understand the risks that come along with all of these things that these care providers just either do or tell you that you need to do. And the fact that you can ask questions, that that's okay to ask questions, and that you can say no. You can say, no, that doesn't feel right for me. I'm not going to do that. Or no, I'm going to do my own research and then I'll get back to you about what my decision is. Mm-hmm. Or if they're not going along with what you're talking about and what's important to you in regards to your birth, then you should have a new provider, or you should look at different ways that you could go about having your baby. Because mm-hmm. if you ignore the fact that your doctor or your care provider is just telling you no, or telling you that's dangerous, or telling you your baby's mm-hmm. going to die if you do this, you don't want to be with that person. That's not the type of energy that you want in your birth space. That's not the type of energy that you want in your life.
In your life, yeah.
And it's really difficult for people to hear that. And it's they take it as you are speaking negatively about them, or that you're...
Or that I'm trying to tell them what their experience was.
Right.
Right? I think that that's really... I mean, why we got the email, why women aren't calling abuse abuse... Mm-hmm. Because I understand the difference between her not feeling like she was assaulted, right? The difference between that and actually she was assaulted.
Right.
Right. And so I understand that my quote unquote interpretation of what happened, what I see when I look at that, can sometimes be different than how it lives in her mind.
Right. Absolutely. I've had a conversation with a very good friend of mine who's also a doula, talking about the fact that as doulas too, sometimes we see these very traumatic situations that occur within the birth space in hospitals, and the person who gives birth does not view it as traumatic because they don't realize that it's obstetric violence. Mm-hmm. And so it's like we carry around that trauma, and then there'll be times where these women don't realize that this was violent towards them and that it could have been avoided. And then it's years down the road and they're sitting there talking to someone and someone shares their traumatic birth experience. And then they're sitting there and they're like, oh my God.
Light bulb moment.
That happened to me, or something similar happened to me. And I did not know that that wasn't normal. I didn't mm-hmm. know that that was abuse because everyone told me it was just normal.
Mm-hmm. And or that he was just doing, you know, what he had to do. Or any of the other ridiculous nonsense. And I mean, I have 3 whole highlights on my Instagram that are all examples of provider abuse.
Right.
And it's like, and it's, of course, not even the tip of the iceberg, but it is real. And it's scary business.
It's very real and it happens every single day. And I think that's the other thing, too, is people don't want to accept that this happens. And they don't want to change their views of care providers. Mm-hmm. And this is not to say, again, like I've said this so many times, this is not to say that every single care provider is going to right. abuse you.
Or that even the individual is the problem.
Yes.
Right? Because it has a lot more to do with their training and their philosophy and the fact that obstetrics and gynecology was founded on the torture and control of women. Mm-hmm. Like, and even, I mean, I was just chatting with a mom. And I was starting to kind of broach that topic. And she was saying, well, you know, my provider's a woman, so I don't really feel like she, you know, really sees women that way because she's a woman. Mm-hmm. And it just goes so much deeper than that.
It's so much deeper than that. And it's also just, I remember watching The Business of Being Born and I was just like, I don't even know why people give birth in hospitals. Mm-hmm. And for anyone who's listening who has not watched The Business of Being Born, please go watch it.
Please go watch it
because this is literally where my issue with like everything within the medical space comes from, is just that people can't profit off of what's natural. Mm-hmm. You can't profit off of that. And mm-hmm. so it comes down to every single medication. Like, yes, trauma care is absolutely necessary. Yes, there is times where Western medicine is absolutely necessary. But again, when it comes to birth, yes, there are times when there are actual emergencies, and then there are times where these emergencies, in air quote, are caused by the cascade of interventions that they put you through that you did not need.
I mean, oh man, I'm going to have to try to figure out what podcast it was that I was listening to where they were quoting someone saying, Western medicine is really good at killing things, mm-hmm. for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. If it's an infection that's going to kill you, you know, sometimes an herb won't take care of that, right? There is a place for that.
There's a time and a place for antibiotics.
Of course.
Absolutely.
There's a time and place for lots of things. And that doesn't make routine distribution of those things acceptable and normal and good.
And I think it's just a lot for people to wrap their head around that the birth space right now and how it is in our healthcare system is not mother and baby friendly.
Yeah.
And people don't want to hear that. They don't want to accept that. But I just go back and I think about even, I remember I was watching videos with my daughter. She loves to watch videos of animals and like animals mm-hmm. in the wild. Mm-hmm. And I found this video just completely on a whim of a mom giraffe giving birth to a baby giraffe. Mm-hmm. And
those are so fun. Those are one of my favorite.
Yeah.
Like,
they're really, cool. They're really, it's amazing to see because you get to watch an animal in their environment give birth to their baby completely undisturbed, not mm-hmm. surrounded by people with probes and all these different things picking and prodding at them.
Yeah.
But so there was one that was like in the wild just giving birth. And then there was one that I don't know if she was like at a sanctuary or something, but she was in this big building and it just felt so unnatural. I mean, but they still left her alone to birth alone, which I just think about that. And I think about how animals in the wild, they give birth and there's no one bothering them and they have their babies. And then it's just like the natural motherly instinct to pick them up or start licking them or doing whatever they need to do mm-hmm. to get their baby to like
try for them. Yeah.
Yeah. To stimulate yeah. them. And it's just like, why is that same concept not applied to women and babies? And it's genuinely because no one will make money off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like how else do you put it? It's crazy. This has been such an awesome conversation, and I feel like we could sit here and continue to talk for hours and hours. And we probably should just have you come back on. Do you have any final pieces of advice for listeners?
Yeah, I think that obviously educating yourself is number one, and taking responsibility for your decisions and not just doing something because someone told you to, you know. Just because your doctor told you that your gestational diabetes screening is routine at 28 weeks or, you know, really look at why. Really look at, does the evidence support routine diabetes screenings? You know, what would I do with this information if it were to come back this way or this way? Will I say yes to an induction if I have a positive screening? You know, all of these questions you need to be thinking about before it's time to make a decision. And it's always okay to ask for time to make a decision. Probably a handful of things in life is drop of the hat, decide yes or no right now.
Right.
And you do have time and you have the right and the responsibility to make a good decision. That's going to look like different things for different people, depending on your circumstances. Sometimes a C-section is a very, very good decision.
Yep.
Right? Of course. That we're not advocating for zero interventions. We're advocating for minimal interventions and at the right time.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you said it like that too. There is a time and a place for interventions. Sometimes they are absolutely necessary. And we're not here saying that they're never necessary. We're here just to make sure that everyone knows what their options are and everyone is provided with information that they need to make a decision in the moment. Again, this has been such an awesome conversation. And I'm so glad that we sat and talked to one another and you shared your wisdom with us and your stories. Would you mind sharing where people can find you if they wanted to reach out?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'm on Instagram at nikki.french. That's N-I-C-K-I.french, like the language. And I also am starting a podcast with Alicia Cruz from At Instinctual Birthing. And the podcast is called Coffee and Consent.
Whee!
And I'm very excited about that project. And we'll get content for that one up and running. But you can follow the Instagram account if you'd like.
Awesome. So I will share your account, your personal one, and then also for your podcast in the show notes so everybody can check it out.
Awesome.
But thank you so, so much for coming and chatting with us. And it just means so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right, listeners. Well, as always, if you enjoyed this episode, please, please, please share it across social media or send it via email to anyone who you feel like would benefit from this podcast. And we will be back next week. Bye.